Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Honorable Supreme Court of Ohio is now in open session pursuant to adjournment.
Good morning. Please be seated. I realize that there are two missing from the bench this morning, but they are watching online today and viewing oral arguments remotely, and they will be fully participating in the decisions that we have today. So this is 2022-0053, 2022-0054. The first is in the matter of the application of Alamo Solar, LLC for a certificate of environmental compatibility and public need. And the second case number is in the matter of the application of Angela Solar, LLC for a certificate of environmental compatibility and public need. For the appellants, Mr. Van Clay. Good morning.
Morning. Chief Justice Kennedy, and may it please the court, I would like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal. The central issue in this case is whether a public utility is required to provide the environmental and safety data required by the board's rules to disclose a project's hazards before the board approves that project. By way of analogy, consider a situation, a hypothetical if you will, in which a developer tells the county engineer that it would like the engineer to approve a project without stormwater calculations because the developer's consultant assures the developer that nobody will be flooded by the project, and therefore the stormwater calculations aren't necessary. I think we would all agree that the county engineer, in the exercise of prudence, would insist that the stormwater calculations be provided in order to prove that what the consultant says was true. Yet in this situation, we have exactly the same scenario where the board has been told by the developer's consultants that in their opinion, nobody living nearby these projects will have their yards or their crops flooded because there won't be any flooding. But no stormwater calculations were required by the board, even though the board's rules specifically require those calculations to be submitted so that the public and the board can vet the claim that no flooding is going to occur. My clients in this situation are farmers, they're homeowners. There are already problems with flooding in the area. And without these stormwater calculations, they cannot be assured that these projects will not flood their crops and their yards. In this case, the board said in its opinion, in this case, the Angelina opinion, that consideration of flooding issues was premature at this point because they wanted to wait and see whether flooding would occur before they decided whether to do anything about it. But that's not what the board's criteria, that is the criteria applicable to board decisions in revised code 4906.10A, require. The board is required by this statute to vet a project's hazards before issuing a certificate in order to decide whether that certificate should be issued and under what conditions it should be issued. In addition, it's very important in this situation or any situation before the board that the public be involved in helping to vet any problems that the project is going to present before that certificate is issued. The General Assembly has set up an elaborate process by which the public is informed of the project. The rules require data to be provided in the application for that project and during the hearing of that project so that the board can be informed and also the public can be informed throughout this process about what problems may result from that facility. In this case, not only did we have the board inform the consultant that no stormwater calculations would be necessary in order to show whether the project is going to produce flooding, but for other hazards from the project, they did the same thing. For example, in the case of water quality, the rules require that water quality data be provided so that the board and the public can determine whether this project's going to produce soil erosion pollution that would damage the streams in the area. Modeling is required for the noise for the project before, not after, the project is provided with the certificate, so that the process in which the public and the board vet the project's hazards from noise can be fully determined. Yet in this case, string inverters, an entire category of inverters that did not have their noise modeled by the developer before the board granted the certificate. Wildlife surveys were not performed, even though the rules require them. Instead, the applicant submitted a small amount of literature on rare and endangered species and said that that satisfied its obligation under the rules, but it didn't, because the rules required a literature survey for all species of plants and animals to be provided, and then for the applicant to look for those species in the project area and around the project area before the certificate is granted to determine whether the project's going to harm wildlife, and conversely, whether the project will cause wildlife to harm the surrounding community. None of that information was provided in this case. As disclosed by our briefs, the consultants for the applicant admitted that none of this information that I've just described was submitted. Nevertheless, the board went ahead and granted the certificate despite the fact that it did not have this information before it to educate it about whether the project was going to harm the public and the environment with respect to these issues, and granted the permit without it. I would add that the board's rules and the statutes applicable to the board require that all this information be provided during the process of determining whether a certificate is going to be issued. The rules were specifically set up to provide the information for the board to determine whether the criteria in revised code 4906.10A are complied with. So it's essentially that the information required by those rules be provided, not only so that the board can determine whether the criteria are met, but also the public early on in the process and throughout the process can assist the board in vetting this information. In this case, that information was not provided. With regard to visual impacts from the facility, which is one of the main issues in this case, vetting the appearance of a solar facility is extremely important to members of the public and especially to my clients. For example, one couple who I represent in one of these cases has a 3-acre parcel of property where their yard and home is located, and they're going to be surrounded on three sides by solar panels that are up to 14 feet tall. So they're going to be essentially surrounded by a sea of metal and glass that looms over their yards. So it's important that the board actually be able to see what the project's actually going to look like to people such as that couple. And for that purpose, the rules provide that simulations be provided to show what that project's going to look like to the people living in that area. But the applicant took shortcuts with the simulations. It provided no simulations that would show what the panels would look like from somebody's backyard. Even though the setbacks in this case allow the developer to site solar panels and fences only 25 feet away from a person's yard, the closest simulation provided by the applicant was 300 feet away, which does not accurately reflect what that project is going to look like by the people who are most affected by that project. So for that and other reasons, we would ask that the board require, or that the court require the board to comply with its own rules with regard to disclosing a project's hazards before the certificate is issued, and not afterwards or not at all, as in this case may be. Your Honor, I see that we have 5 minutes left. If no one has any questions, I'd like to reserve the rest of my time.
Okay.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. Well, good morning, Mr. Margard.
Morning, Your Honor.
You're going to share your time with Mr. Settinari.
3 minutes.
You're going to take 12, and he's going to take 3.
Yes, Your Honor.
Super. Good morning.
Good morning. And may it please the court. The board staff in this case determined that it had sufficient information to be able to evaluate these applications. The applications.
What's your response to the 25 feet versus 300 feet statement by your opponent?
With respect to the visual assessment.
Yes.
So there were more than 34 different reference points from which photographs were taken to be able to gauge what the visual impact would be. Those were all representative throughout the project area, and they were specifically chosen to be points that had the most unobstructive view of the project. But what the applicant or what the appellants want is essentially to see what the view was from their backyard. We don't have access to their backyards. The applicant didn't. All of the applicant's views were taken from public roadways, but they were representative, and in fact, some of those were from roadways adjacent to those affected neighbors. So they are, in fact, representative of the project area.
So, but they have access to the property to which the panels are going to be constructed, so why not go to that property and take those same photographs looking back at the other properties? Why just stick to the roadways?
That was the expert's determination, was that that was the best way to gauge what the view would be. It's important to realize the visual impact is not just to the adjacent landowner. It's going to be to everybody who passes by this project. And so while the adjacent landowner will be most affected by that view, the number of people who would be affected generally are the traveling public. And so it's appropriate to take that from the road because that's going to be most representative of those who are going to see the project.
So let's talk about the flood issue that they raise. So let's hypothetically say they build the project and there is a flooding problem. There's groundwater that's accumulating. Who is actually qualified to then go in and remediate that site and to get it to drain properly?
Well, it would be the applicant's responsibility to do that. And of course, it depends on what the nature of the problem is. These farm fields, of course, have drainage tiles in them. And to the extent that drainage tiles are damaged and that's causing the flooding, it is the responsibility of the applicant operator to be able to go in to repair those drainage tiles to ensure that the flooding is mitigated.
And is that in the certificate, that if there's flooding, then that applicant is responsible to go in and remediate the site at their cost?
It is.
Where can I find that?
I don't recall the specific condition. Perhaps my co-counsel can identify that, but that is one of the conditions, is that remediation has to occur in a timely fashion. And I think it's important to realize.
It doesn't.
Well, there are complaint processes available. There's an informal complaint process, and the operator is obligated to respond within 48 hours of an informal complaint being raised. If that's not resolved to the satisfaction of the complainant, there are formal procedures that can be initiated at the board. with respect to the flooding specifically. Issues were raised about a developer, for example, and what would you expect to be provided. The board's rules provide that while there is a requirement that that be quantified during construction and during operation, that an applicant can identify specific requirements that don't apply to its project. And if they explain why the requirement does not apply, they don't need to supply that information. That happened with respect to that specific requirement in this case. The applicants actually, on 16 different instances, indicated that there were requirements that did not apply to their project. And what they indicated was that no drainage was expected from the construction or from the operation of this project. So the stormwater was not an issue. But more than that, there are conditions in this certificate that require them to have a variety of permits issued by the Environmental Protection Agency.
So how do you decide that? How do you determine that that condition doesn't apply, that it's going to, it will not affect?
Well, they did it on the basis of their expert, who is trained with much experience in these projects, and said that particularly given the topography of the land and the nature of the land, the nature of the soils, that excess drainage would not be anticipated. And in fact, because of the nature of the plantings that they'll have, the amount of drainage will be considerably reduced during the operation of this facility. But as I indicated, there are a number of permits that they also have to have. They're administered by the EPA. And those permits do require best management practices and also require some measurement of any drainage that may occur. So there will be ways of monitoring and tracking that, and there will be oversight of that throughout the project as one of the conditions. There were a number of other items that Learned Counsel raised that perhaps overstate the case. For example, he indicated that there were modeling that was required for certain of the noise considerations. Specifically, they raised the issue with respect to string inverters. There is, in fact, no requirement in the board's rules that noise be modeled for sound projects, for solar projects, and specifically for string inverters. The rule that he references pertains to wind farms, not to solar projects. So the rule that he's relying on is inapplicable here.
What about decommissioning? So as I read the statute, there has to be a plan for decommissioning. It has to be done before the project. At what stage is that then examined, and where is the money held to ensure decommissioning in an appropriate, safe, environmental, non-hazardous way to humans?
So all of that is done pre-construction. All of that has to be in place. The bonds have to be in place. And that's revisited every 5 years to ensure that there's adequate bonding to ensure that the decommissioning can occur. And all of that is part of the conditions in the certificate.
And what's the life before a panel's decommissioned?
Well, panels may vary, and of course, panels will be replaced from time to time, but the life of the project is anticipated to be 40 years. I also want to address one of the other issues that Learned Counsel raised, and that had to do with the wildlife, for example. He indicates that there were no surveys done. In fact, there were surveys done. There were literature surveys that were done, and there were field surveys done, three different field surveys that were done. All of those surveys were done in coordination with and cooperation with a variety of different agencies, including the Department of Agriculture, including the EPA, including the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. So all of the necessary wildlife surveys were, in fact, conducted in this case. And the wildlife that was identified in the literature survey was, in fact, reported as part of the field surveys. They basically determined that because of the nature of this land, it's not suitable for wildlife. And so there was very little wildlife observed, and there was no rare, threatened, or endangered species observed as part of those surveys. So in short, what's happened here is that the application satisfied the board's rule.
So the statute says that you're supposed to provide a literature survey of plant animal life within a quarter mile of the project area, and that the survey shall include aquatic and terrestrial plant animal species of commercial recreation value or species designated as endangered or threatened. What your opponent says is that that's all you looked for, and that include is not, include means it has to be in there, but you're also required to survey for other plant and animal life, and that you didn't do that.
Well,
do you disagree with their reading of the statute, or do you disagree with the fact with what they say is a factual matter?
Well, Your Honor, this is a rule. This isn't a statute.
And
the rule does, in fact, say shall include, as you indicate. And the literature survey did indicate that there were a variety of the typical kinds of flora and fauna that one would find in farmland. They specifically focused on those commercial and recreational species, because that's what the rule requires, and found that it was just, again, the typical fox, squirrels, raccoons, deer. And then they focused primarily on the rare, threatened, and endangered species. But in fact, the surveys did look at the wildlife that was expected within that project area. It's just that that area is not conducive to wildlife. Okay. With respect, Your Honor, I submit that the board's decision in this case was based on sufficient, substantial, credible, and probative evidence of record. It was reasonable and lawful and should be affirmed. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Settinari, good morning.
Good morning, Chief Justice Kennedy. May it please the court. My name is Mike Settinari on behalf of the intervening appellees, Angelina Solar and Alamo Solar. I have three quick points. This case is a factual case. There are no legal issues presented in this case. It's about the sufficiency of the evidence that the board relied upon to make its decision. Two, just a side note, the local governmental entities support this project. Local government entities signed the stipulation as well as recommended approval of the project to the board. Lastly, the appellants had a meaningful opportunity to participate in this case. There was no harm or prejudice to the appellants. Going back to the factual issues here, again, there's no statutory interpretation involved here. So this court's decision in TWISM from late December, doesn't apply here. This is a factual determination. Did the board have sufficient evidence to make its decision? Did the applicant provide sufficient information? And we submit the applicant did. We have two professional civil engineers testified on water quality, runoff. That runoff would be less with this project because you're taking agricultural land that's being disturbed, converting it to vegetated surfaces. We have that in the record. We have testimony from Mr. David Hessler, a 30-year acoustic engineer, who testified that sound at the property lines, as well as residences, would essentially be inaudible. And in fact, the record has that the sound would be less than a quiet library, less than an empty theater. These sound levels, as Mr. Hessler testified, are so low, they're essentially inaudible. So we have sufficient evidence in the record that supports the board's decision. And again, this is a factual case, not a legal case. Local governmental entities that supported the project, it's worth noting, Preble County Board of Commissioners, Preble County Planning Commission, Preble County Engineer, various Township Board of Trustees signed both stipulations in the cases, as well as recommending approval of the project and negotiated the conditions. It's important to look at the conditions in the stipulation. Chief Justice Kennedy, I think others asked some questions about it. Those conditions are extremely comprehensive. There's a decommissioning condition. There's a drainage condition that involves the county engineer's assistance. So there's a very much, all those conditions are meant to be very protective.
So who remediates? So there's a problem. So are you saying that the county engineer of Preble County has now signed off on being the person responsible to remediate a groundwater problem?
Again, you have to look at the exact language in the stipulation and the conditions. They were heavily negotiated, and that's in the record. The county engineer is there to look at the repair that's being done by the applicant. By the way, it's a developer. It's not a public utility. It's a developer. The applicant will own and operate the project. The applicant will be responsible for repairing drain tiles. The county engineer's involvement is as to the repair being made. If there's a difference of opinion, because staff's involved and the board has oversight, at the end of the day, staff makes the final call on it. But you'll see that in the language and the conditions. The conditions are very important to look at because when you read the conditions, you'll see they're very protective, including a noise condition where any inverter issue related to operational noise has to be mitigated. That eliminates any inverter issues whatsoever. So again, we're back to talking about the facts and what the board relied upon here. The last thing is the appellants had a meaningful opportunity to participate. They put on witnesses. They served discovery. They cross-examined. They could have but did not object to the application going into the record. They could have but did not object to the application's determination of completeness. They had every opportunity to participate. There was no harm or prejudice here whatsoever. Again, these are all factual issues, and so I'd submit to the court that the board's decisions were appropriate, fully supported by the record, and we ask that this court affirm both decisions. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Mr. Van Clay.
Thank you, Norm. First of all, with regard to the noise modeling, the regulation that requires noise modeling to be done for solar facilities is cited in our brief. It's OAC 4906-4-08A3. And that applies to solar facilities. It requires modeling or other data to be provided on the noise produced at the boundary of the facility or the noise that will be experienced by at people's homes around the facility. That was not provided for the string inverters in this case. With regard to the surveys for wildlife, the surveys that council mentioned were not surveys for wildlife. They were surveys of wetlands and streams and habitat, not for animals specifically. And in fact, the expert in both cases for the developer admitted that no field surveys were done for any plants or animals. They did notice that maybe a squirrel or a deer was seen when they went out to take a look at a wetland. That was the extent of it. With regard to the drainage issue, the situation that the board and the developer have presented us with here is that if flooding does occur, the damage is going to be done before anything can be done about it. That is, under the board's decision, the neighbors are already going to be flooded before they determine that the project is a flooding hazard, because the stormwater calculations designed to show whether it's going to be a hazard and to prevent it from being a hazard weren't followed. After the fact mitigation, after the fact correction is a very poor substitute for good decision making required under the criteria of the statute to prevent that harm from occurring to the public. With regard to the simulations, council said that there were 25, 30 photographs taken. True, but only 4 in one case and 5 in the other case actually had simulations added to them to show how the project was going to look in those settings. With regard to the distance, it's not necessarily necessary to do the simulation in somebody's backyard to disclose how it's going to look to somebody from their backyard. Doing the simulation 25 feet from the road would accomplish the same purpose, but they didn't do that. They did a simulation at 300, 600, and 900 feet away from the road so that nobody at the board can see how this project is going to look to that poor couple who's surrounded on three sides by panels and other people who are in the same situation. Council stated that there's no factual issues, that all the issues in this case are factual, they're not legal. I think the reverse is true, because with regard to the facts that this data required by the rules wasn't provided, their own consultants admitted all of that. So what we have left is a legal issue, whether that information has to be provided before the decision's issued or not.
So your best argument of what statute was violated by granting of this certificate?
It would be the criteria in 4906.10A, and also the regulations that the board is required to follow in order to make a decision under those criteria, because it violated its own regulations. With regard to the drainage, I would also mention that
What about your adversary's contention that they can waive those provisions of the administrative code?
They can if they follow the waiver rule. There's a specific rule in the board's regulations which says if you don't believe that it's necessary in a particular case not to provide information by rule, you can request a formal waiver of that provision, which is adjudicated. That is, the public can look at the request for the waiver, object to it if they wish. No waivers were requested
data. Did you raise that in your briefs, that they hadn't followed the procedure?
Yes. Yes, in these briefs, yes.
Mm-hmm.
And in the briefs below as well. They did not follow the waiver procedure in order to give themselves, or in order to apply to the judge in those cases, for permission to ignore any requirements of these rules. They did it for some other requirements that we weren't contesting, but not for these. Such as the requirement to take a look at the visual impact of the facilities more than 5 miles away. We agreed that there were no impacts more than 5 miles away, so they only had to look at visual impacts within 5 miles and not within 10 miles as the rules of the board require. So that's an example of an instance where they specifically asked for a waiver of a requirement in the rules. It was granted, everybody was okay with it, but they didn't ask for waivers for any of this other information that is described in our brief as being missing from the record. And it's the entire record, not just the application. They had opportunities during two hearings in both cases to produce the information required by rule, and they didn't do it. Your Honor, I see that my time has expired. If there are no more questions, then I would close my remarks.
Well, thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Good morning. And we take the matter under advisement, and you'll receive a copy of the decision in the mail. Marshall, would you call a recess?
All rise.